Welcome to Swiss Seduc. My name is Hans Fischer, and my guest is Paul Anderson. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you.
Your book, Hungry's Brides, is about two women, Sor Juana, who lived in the 17th century in Mexico, and Beulah, a 20th century Canadian. What are their life stories?
Well, the easiest one to talk about is the historical figure of Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. A lot of people, and this is now in many different countries, in Canada, the United States, Scotland, England, when they begin to hear about her, they say, but wait a minute, this is a real person. This is someone who lived. And I said, yes. They said, but it's incredible. We've never heard of her. At best, a few people will have heard of her, maybe read a poem or two, but really have very little sense of what her life was like. It's completely different in the Spanish-speaking world. There, virtually everyone knows about her. And in Mexico, you can mention her name and people will give you a few verses of a favorite poem.
So, in your story, what is the plot, actually?
Well, there are the two tracks. There's a 17th century track and a 20th century track. And the 17th century story opens, I wanted it to open somewhat dramatically, and so it opens with a scene very near the death of Sor Juana in 1695. And then the next chapter in the book basically begins at the beginning, takes us all the way back to 1648, to where Juana was born, very near the volcanoes that are on the east slope of the, or the east side of the Valley of Mexico. She was born there. She was raised by the descendants of the Aztecs. That is, her grandfather had rented a hacienda that her mother ran, she managed. And the labor force were Nahua Indians who spoke the same language as the Aztecs. She was a child prodigy, really a prodigy perhaps on a par with the young Mozart, for example. She taught herself to read at the age of three. By the age of 11, she had read all the books in her grandfather's library, which, as it happens, was one of the finest private collections in the New World. It would have been probably 3,000 volumes. There weren't a lot of books for children then, so this child was reading, would have been reading classics, and that was an interesting thing to look into. What is the education of a great poet? So that was fun to look at. She lived until she was about 12 in the countryside. She spoke Nahuatl, the language of the Aztecs, fluently. We know that because she even wrote verses in it. And one of my first questions when I was doing the research was, yes, but how well? And so I was lucky enough to meet an expert who had just finished a paper on that question. How well did Sor Juana, on the evidence of the verses that we have, how well would she have spoken it? And it was his impression that she may very well have been the greatest poet in two languages. The greatest living poet, at least, in two languages, not just one. She moved from there to the city of Mexico, which was a very significant urban center even then. Probably had 400,000 people at the time. And it was a city set on a lake. Very soon, she was introduced by her aunt, who was married to a wealthy man, who was introduced at court. And the rumors... She was a very beautiful young girl, and the rumor is that this great beauty was also weirdly learned, weirdly intelligent, spread like wildfire through good society in the capital. And at one point, a kind of colloquium of 40 scholars was convoked, and it was their task to determine if the rumors of her learning were true, and then maybe there was also a darker function, which was to try to arrive at a determination of where that learning came from. Was it instilled by God, or might there have been some other source? So I imagined it as a kind of a Baroque entertainment in the palace. Here we have probably a 14-year-old girl facing 40 scholars. At least the number has a kind of mythic resonance, and that's how the story's told. And the vice king of the time lived to be a very old man, and he told the story of that day for the rest of his life. I can imagine him becoming a bit of an old bore telling it. He lived to be 105, and he remembered that day. He claimed very clearly watching Sor Juana, this young girl surrounded by experts in theology and history and philosophy and the new natural sciences, etc. He said it was like watching a galleon, Spanish galleon, fending off canoes. So she made a spectacular impression. And so this poor country girl, I mean, her parents were very modest means, born out of wedlock, so she was a bastard child at a time when racial purity and lineage and family name meant everything, very quickly became the favorite handmaiden of the vice queen of the New World. The vice queen herself had been the handmaiden of the empress, so it was the, generally speaking, the daughters of the very best, very most powerful families who had that opportunity, and here was this freakish girl. She was lived at court for a few years, and in that time became the poet of choice for occasions of state, writing poetry on various occasions, a sort of court poet by the time she was 16. And then suddenly she entered a convent at the age of 19. So that's one of the mysteries surrounding her life. Why? Spent the next 25 years, she spent actually just a few months in that first convent and then left it for another one. There was a period of 6 months in between that we know very little about, but you have to imagine that her situation would have been very irregular, to leave a palace for a convent, then leave that convent again, and then finally enter a more lenient one. The first one was very strict. It would appear that there were some health problems, perhaps some psychological problems to do with the kind of place that it was. There was a lot of self-mortification, a lot of flagellation. It would have been perhaps a frightening place for a young girl to be. I think she realized that wasn't the place for her. She was lucky enough to be able to leave and then to get a second dowry, because to enter a convent meant that you had to supply a very significant dowry, and entered this second convent where she lived out the rest of her life, 25 years. Her confessor was the chief censor for the Inquisition, a man with a photographic memory. And so you can imagine this very creative poet who was interested in every branch and domain of knowledge, confessing to someone with a photographic memory who was also intimately connected with the Inquisition. So that, I think that was a defining relationship. She managed to resist and to pursue her career very boldly, even recklessly at times. She created a space for herself by serving the court as court poet, even while she was in the convent, and serving the church by writing carols for the people for various religious occasions. And so she was able to play these two power centers of power off against each other and create a little space for herself for a while, for 25 years actually. And then things began to change. The new vice king, her patrons, the vice king and vice queen, returned to Spain, and the incoming vice king and vice queen she had a less warm relationship with. The vice king appears not to have been a very capable man, and when the difficulties of the time began to multiply, he was not able to rise to the occasion. The status of the status and power of the crown, the Spanish crown, was in sharp decline at the same time as the power of the church was ever more in the ascendant. And the occasion really was a series of natural disasters that coincided really with the last days of the Spanish Empire. So we have a fairly dramatic change in circumstances for Sor Juana at the precise moment when the Spanish Empire itself was clearly in sharp decline. So from 1691 to 1692, there was a period where it almost never stopped raining. The city is on a lake, and the lake level rises, and the canals overflow. The surrounding countryside, then the crops and so on, molder in the fields. There's a blight. There are infestations of insects, and suddenly real hunger is upon the land. Then, as if that weren't enough, there are a series of medium strength volcanic eruptions and earthquakes, and then a total eclipse of the sun on August 23rd, 1691. And so there's just this multiplication of calamities. And at the time, in the 17th century, these things meant something. I mean, even in the 20th century, if a series of events like that happened to one people, they would say, even now, in a fairly secular time, why us? Why is this happening? What does it mean? In the 17th century, that questioning would have been very intense. So you have a viceregal administration that is not able really to do very much. There wouldn't be much to be done, but he's clearly not able to demonstrate strength or competence. Eventually you have real hunger, growing disorder, and then finally rioting in the streets. The church, meanwhile, is actually acting fairly capably. One of Sor Juana's, in a sense, Sor Juana's betrayer, but an old friend, the bishop of a neighboring city, had been buying grain through this period, and instead of hoarding it and selling it at an increased price, he was actually selling it at a lower price, demonstrating to the people that they were selling at a loss. So in fact, the church administrators were probably better, even in worldly matters at that point, than the crown representatives. And that space that Sor Juana had created between these two equal centers of power suddenly no longer existed. And she found herself increasingly under the authority of the sole authority of the archbishop, who was maybe the greatest hater of women in history. He hated to hear women's voices. He hated to hear them sing. He publicly thanked his stars over and over that he had weak eyesight so as not to have to look at these creatures. He would not eat food prepared by the hand of a woman, and once upon returning to his palace from the cathedral, when he heard that a woman had walked across the courtyard of his palace, he had the flagstones torn up and replaced. Now, in the midst of all of this, he has in his city this monstrously learned, increasingly famous now throughout the Spanish Empire, and now the news is filtering into France and Italy, for example. This woman in his midst, this towering figure to whom the inquisitors would bring their rulings in order to get her feedback, in order to get her criticism. Priests who were about to give sermons would come and ask for her advice on their reasoning. So there's this woman who's in the city, but not only that, she's in a convent directly under this archbishop's authority, and she's rebellious, and she has people to her convent constantly, and it's become a very worldly center for letters, and he hated the theater, and she's a playwright. There was, they were just, in a sense, made for each other if the outcome was to be a disaster. And we know that she gave up. She had in her cell, these were quite large. We think of a cell being small, but these were on two stories, having four or five rooms. She had amassed a collection that would have exceeded even her grandfather's when she was a child, of perhaps 5,000 books, and all kinds of musical and scientific instruments. She was interested in in everything, basically mathematics, the new science, navigation, optics. She was maybe one of the great musical theorists or cosmologists of her time. So at one point she gave all of these things up in a very dramatic gesture in about 1693, ceased writing, signed two final statements of contrition, expressing regret and remorse for having spent, wasted so much of her time on worldly studies, having spent too little time on sacred studies. And it is the last we hear from her until we have a record of her death 2 years later in 1695, when a plague breaks out in the Valley of Mexico. It enters the convent. Apparently she died nursing her sisters at the age of about 46.